from Relay, this is Downstream, a podcast about the present and future of television. This is episode 111, recorded January the 23rd, 2026, a new year. I am your master of ceremonies, who totally knows what year it is, Jason Snell, and I am joined once again by Joe Adalian, West Coast editor at Vulture. Joe, welcome back. It's good to hear your voice.
It's good to be back, and welcome to 2026 or whatever new year this is. I've lost track myself.
I don't even know. I'm still right in 2025.
Does anyone really ever know what time it is?
That's a very old music reference. You could get on old person pop culture Jeopardy with that.
If you get this reference, it may be time to schedule your colonoscopy.
Yeah, that's what I was going
to
say.
Note to self.
It's what time is it? It's 25 or 6 to 4. Anyway, we are going to talk about present and future TV. I already said that. That's what this podcast is about. But we should get started with everybody's favorite topic, which is corporate shenanigans. But we have to do it because it's important to the industry. It's about Netflix and Paramount and their battle for Warner.
One battle after another. That's all it is.
Music to Warner Brothers. Amidst all of this, the fact that the Warner Brothers film people have had such a great year last year and now have cleaned up in the Oscar nominations. It's just very funny as they were one movie away from getting fired and their whole company is for sale. And they had a good year. It's a good timing. I guess I would say good timing to have such a good year with
the
Sinners.
Best part of the. Yeah, the best part of, with Sinners and One Battle After Another, I'm sorry, Andrew, but the best part of the otherwise Golden Globes was seeing the head of Warner, the co-head of Warner Brothers Pictures next to David Zaslav.
Oh, man.
And like as he's being thanked from stage and him saying like, no, not so much. You know, we don't want to talk about it because it's too much because, you know, the David might be embarrassed.
Yeah, thanks to Zaz for not firing us. Sorry, DZ, right? Do you say they call him DZ?
I think, yes. Only it's more DZ than Zaz.
Yeah, I think Zaz is a funnier name, but it's not what people call him. Anyway, so Paramount keeps complaining, right? They keep complaining. I think they filed a lawsuit.
I think
somewhere.
The word is whining. Whining
is
the word you're
looking
for.
Because they're like, but Arvid is better. And they did.
Daddy said I could have Warner Brothers.
Yeah, and it's not great. So one of the things that's going on is obviously a bone of contention here is the value of the cable channels. And Netflix says they have value, and Paramount says that the Warner cable channels do not have value, essentially, and because Netflix doesn't want to buy them. So Netflix says, when we buy Warner, we're going to give you money, and more on that in a second, we're going to give you money, and then also you're going to be able to make money because you're going to sell off those cable channels. And Paramount's like, no, we want the whole thing, and if you add our bid versus their bid plus the value, which is zero, of the cable channels, our bid is better. The funny thing about this whole situation is Warner is in an agreement with Netflix, which means that Paramount can't negotiate with Warner. They're not legally allowed, or Warner's not legally allowed to talk to them because they're locked in an agreement with Netflix. And as a result, and I have to admit, it is pretty funny. The only way that Warner can communicate with Paramount is publicly. So their executives go on like CNBC and talk generally about what, you know, their issues are with what Paramount is doing because they can't actually talk to them directly. So I just find that hilarious and fascinating that they basically have to use the media to relay their dissatisfaction with the Paramount bids back to Paramount because they can't actually talk to them directly because technically they already have agreed to a suitor and that the other suitor is not part of the deal.
I'm imagining Paramount or Warner Brothers putting content blockers on all its employees' computers, like, you know, not to go to CNBC or CNN, and also, well, you have to go to CNN, I guess they are CNN, but David Zaslav just sitting there with his hands over his ears, I can't hear you.
Yeah, blink twice if you're trying to communicate with Paramount.
I mean, it is ridiculous. First of all, I do want to say, like, you know, if you haven't already, I had nothing to do with the production of this story, but y'all should Google Flyboys, Paramount, Ellison's, Vulture. One of my colleagues, Reeves, did an amazing story looking at the Ellisons and their ambitions and what they really want and all. Well, this really is all about daddy issues.
That's such a great story.
And it really was. And he just is there. And you know, it, this battle, I do not pretend to understand how it's going to play out. And certainly as a journalism major, I'm bad at math. So mm-hmm. I can't claim to quite understand the dynamics of it all, except I do think, you know, both sides are embellishing in terms of this whole cable issue. I don't think the cable networks are worth nothing, despite, you know, you see if, you know, Versant, the NBC Universal spinoff with the cable networks, its stock was down, and suddenly all the Larry Ellison acolytes in the press are like, oh, see, this means cable's not worth anything. You know, first of all, Versant's cable portfolio is not the same as what the Warner Brothers Discovery networks are. Warner Brothers Discovery has networks like the Food Network, TLC, all these that still do decent business. They've got CNN, which certainly not what it once was, but still cranks out $500 million in profits every year, which is way down, but it's still there. So there is absolutely value. So it's not as much as Warner Brothers would, of course, would like to think it is, because Zaslav has a high opinion of both himself and his company, but it's also not nothing. So, you know, they split the middle. And, you know, I truly don't if it weren't for the Trump of it all, I would think that this deal would be done. I no idea what happens.
I have said from the beginning that I actually don't believe that Paramount's gonna make it here, and they have made some right. Like, one of the things Warner mentioned in public, because they can't talk to them directly, is that they rejected it in part because it wasn't really backstopped by Larry Ellison's money. It was backstopped by this revocable trust, which basically means that if they didn't want to spend the money, he would just revoke the trust, and they would be left holding the bag, which is not great. And apparently they then modified and said, No, Larry will personally guarantee it and all of that. So it's like, okay, there's some negotiation going on kind of like in public there. Netflix, by the way, and this is the cash thing I would mention earlier, they were going to do cash and stock. They actually have lined up financing where they're going to pay for Warner Brothers entirely in cash. And the idea there is not to sweeten the deal so much as it is to speed things along, because an all cash offer is less. And again, I was a communication major and have a journalism degree. I got good grades in math, but it's been so long that I can't do math anymore. Just saying, there are some regulatory things that happen when it's cash that don't happen when it's cash, that have to happen when stock is involved. So
sort of like when you go to this supermarket or whatever, you pay cash, you get a little discount. Yeah, it's a little faster.
Yeah, greasing,
or gasoline.
They're trying to grease the skids at the moment where Paramount is trying to throw sand on the tracks. Paramount is Netflix is trying to grease the skids and say, no, we're going to make it even go faster. We want this through and we want this done. And there's still hoops to jump through. I am warming also to the theory that Larry Ellison maybe feels like he's done enough. Keep in mind that, you know, it's daddy's money who's already spent for Paramount. I'll also point out Larry Ellison, actually a savvy businessman. Like, buying a movie studio is not a great idea from a business standpoint. Buying two seems to be a really bad idea. And anyone will tell you there's no business sense in this deal, in Paramount trying to buy Warner. It's not going to make money. It's just about power and control. It's a bad deal. And I wonder, I mean, again, Larry Ellison's basically the richest man in the world. He could just say, okay, David, here's more money. And that hasn't happened. And that makes me feel like Larry Ellison already bought his son a movie studio. He's not going to buy him another one. And like, this is as far as he was willing to go. We'll see, because as several writers have said, if they sweeten their deal, they could probably blow Netflix out of the water, because Netflix will not beat them on price if Larry Ellison's willing to overspend for it.
Yes and no. I mean, I think, yes, is there a point where Netflix walks away? Sure. But both parties are almost certainly engaged in a little bit of a game of chicken. You know, nobody wants to overspend. Everyone thinks about, you know, Disney overspent for this. But also, overspending is also not, you know, out of line in Hollywood. I mean, NBC Universal dramatically overspent on the NBA and is losing hundreds of millions of dollars on a deal that is never going to be profitable and probably doesn't make sense. But because executives there egotistically think that they're a sports channel and that's the only way to make their part of the business work, they're going to dive into it, and we'll see what happens. And the same thing, Netflix will, both sides have a limit, and we don't really know what it is. I doubt Netflix has made its last, best, and final offer either, but they're certainly not going to telegraph that. They're going to try to get by on the strength of, we're Netflix, damn it. Yeah. And it does make a lot of sense, because I'm sorry, if you're a modern media company, and you, so again, for at least 5 to 10 years now, people at other media companies, at legacy media companies, have said, my God, I wish we would get bought by Netflix. That's what they wanted, because mm-hmm. they saw the power of that platform. So if you have a chance to get on the, you know, the finest bullet train in Europe, or you get a chance to go on some Amtrak, you know, hasn't been remodeled in 25, 30 years, and maybe you get a cold sandwich. And it, look, Amtrak has a lot of good people at Amtrak. I'm like, right, Joe Biden, love my trains, and I read every single story about people who are on trains. And
but
like,
it's not the Shinkansen.
You know, but exactly. And it's not it's like, Japan, you know, yeah, public transit in London, my guy, it's, yeah, you know, or in Brussels, you know, that's just, it's so light years ahead. So if you can be one of those, the only variable, of course, in all of this is, David Zaslav has sort of proven again and again, he truly doesn't care what's good for Warner Brothers or what's right, good for Discovery. He cares what's going to make him the most much money, yep, and makes him look the smartest. And which is why, by the way, I think he took the Netflix deal, not just for money, but because it also, I think in the back of his mind, it is the coolest deal. It's sort of like, wow, if they want us, yeah, I couldn't have really screwed this up. But now that he's sort of gotten the interest, now it's just about like, okay, at the end of the day, who makes me the most,
yeah,
money?
And that's, I think, what it'll go, I mean, with. He's a business guy. I think in the end of the day, that is what they're all motivated by. I think you make a really great point about ego, because this is the entertainment industry. There are a lot of big egos going on here. And that's why I feel like in some ways this story is almost impervious to rational business analysis, because right, there are rational cases to be made. I think the Netflix bid is rational. I don't think anything involving Paramount and David Ellison is happening because of rationality. I think it's all about ego. And, you know, I can't handicap ego. Like, if they want to pay more money and have it not make sense, I can't predict that, and I can't handicap right, it. Like, they, right, rich guys can do whatever they want, and so right, you the ability to analyze it kind of falls away. It's like, I don't know, what will the billionaires do, and there's no answer to that.
I will say, in terms of rationale, it's not completely. I can sort of on some vague outlines see where Paramount could want Warner Brothers in 2025 and 2026. But anyway, you know, they there's some sense of, you know, it could make sense if you buy Warner Brothers and dramatically slash it, and you mm-hmm. just want the IP and you don't care about the infrastructure. And despite all the movie theater owners and people say, well, Warner Brothers and Paramount too, so it's like, come on.
Yeah, right.
Like, you're on crack. Did you not see what Disney did to Fox?
You can see how redundant
yes,
that purchase is.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's once you slash it and you do all the redundancies, you paid a lot of money
right,
for a
yes,
cut of meat out of a, you bought the whole cow and you wanted a cut of meat from it. It seems inefficient.
It seems inefficient unless you think it's going to be the thing that makes you one of the last three or four platforms
standing.
That
yeah.
so in 5 or 10 years, ultimately, it was like, well, it was a tough case. So there's some of that, but it's very, very risky and not. Whereas with Netflix, it makes some sense. And Netflix is also going to institute cuts. There's no doubt about it. They mm-hmm. don't need a company as big as Warner Brothers in its current status, which is one reason why they're not picking up the cable side, which is another benefit. You know, let the cable networks fend for themselves, let them create equity, let them go and merge with Versant or private, whatever is going to happen. Let that business find its right, go away and make its money. And I think can be a good business. I think there's still a good 15 years left in the cable bundle. I could be wrong. Certainly everyone in the cable business seems to be, in network business seems to be trying to wind it down as soon as possible, because they keep making decisions that make no sense to me and are not for long. But anyway, I think Netflix will make cuts, but Netflix, if anything, you know, they say, oh, we're still going to make as many movies as we did. They said on their earnings call this week, you know, we're still going to have our Netflix movie division. It's like, and yes, they will. I would be shocked if that Netflix movie division doesn't pivot completely to focusing on making movies like Champagne Problems that they can be made efficiently
yes.
and do a lot of business, as opposed to the $200 million. They've already assisted some
yeah.
of that.
They don't need to make faux theatrical movies because
they don't need
have
to make the
theatrical.
They can make, yeah, the rip
yeah,
can become a Warner Brothers
yeah.
film.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
it can live on the star, and it just 100%. So, yeah. We'll see what happens.
A couple other details here that I wanted to mention. So Netflix just paid, it's a deal with Sony for pay one streaming, which is like, you know, first streaming window for Sony films that could, depending on how the film's gross, be up to $8 billion. And this is something that Matt Bellany at Puck made, I thought, a good comment, which is one of the reasons you want to buy Warner Brothers is for a content acquisition. That you look at the price tag of Warner Brothers and you're like, oh, that's a lot of money. But it's like, but look, Netflix just signed an $8 billion deal with Sony for content licensing. So if you make more of the content yourself, and you have a content engine, then that is a better fit for your business. And I just thought that was an interesting point. It's right. Not like Netflix has no costs and now is going to buy a studio. It's like, no, they're paying lots of money to rent IP from studios, right. Rent titles, rent these films, and then right. those licenses end, and then they got to pay more money again. Right. It's good business for Sony, but if you're Netflix, you're like, you know, what if we just had all the Warner Brothers movies?
Right. You save some money. Of course, Netflix will then have to want to, it'll be curious to see what Netflix does, because Netflix tends to right. want to like own its movies exclusively and have them, but you need to also monetize that library.
Exactly.
So Netflix is going to, you know, Disney, which started out when they launched Disney Plus, was like, we're taking it all back. It's all on Disney Plus. Well, now all of a sudden Disney movies are showing up on Netflix.
Yeah.
Because you need to be able to sell it. It's about those windows.
It's like, and the circle of life, Joe.
Like, it is.
You bring it all in-house and then you're like, it doesn't need to all be here.
Exactly. Netflix has also started. Netflix is taking stuff that they don't have exclusively now too. They're finding some value in that, they just pay a little bit less for it. Yeah. Look, by the way, the one thing I will say with that Sony deal, just I don't know if it's been made clear, is Netflix already had a deal with Sony for the U.S., but what this does is it takes it international and allows them to sort of monetize it around the world, which Netflix loves. They love to be able to push everything to everyone, and it's very efficient for Sony too, as opposed to having to worry about 15 different deals.
It does make it easy, doesn't it?
Yes.
The other thing I wanted to talk to you about is movie theater people are very suspicious of Ted Sarandos at Netflix. And I think this is interesting. Like, he's been their designated enemy because he represents the threat of streaming, and his attitude, which is like, we don't even want to release movies theatrically. What would be the point? And when they do it, it's because like some director wants us to, and we're only going to do it for a little bit and only to get an award, but we really don't want to be there. It hasn't helped. But this is one of those things where, look, I'm not in this industry. I am viewing it from afar. But to me, I look at this and say, what they have portrayed him, don't believe your own distorted portrayal of them as the villain that you need to use to promote your own side of the argument. But I feel like some people have like just decided that, oh, he is the boogeyman. It's like, he's not the boogeyman. But the thing that I've learned about Netflix and about Ted Sarandos and about that whole operation in following this for the last few years is they're smart at business and they're entirely flexible about changing strategy.
Ted said this in the quarterly earnings. He said this phrase before. As I went back and is going back as far as 2019, he said this phrase, it's a business, not a religion, which is another is a wonderful way of saying we'll be flexible,
and
right?
So, maybe it's moot posturing now by the movie theater industry, but like, I think the act of saying we're going to purchase Warner Brothers is Netflix, because I heard when this was announced, a lot of people were like, why would they do that? And it's like, well, remember back, you don't have to go back that far to remember when Netflix wasn't going to do ads, right? When they weren't going to have tiers, when they were going to, you know,
have sports,
when they weren't going to do live events, when they weren't going to do sports. And you can go all the way back to when they decided that they were going to be a streaming service and not just a DVD in the mail company. Over the years, Netflix has transformed its business and its strategy multiple times to things that they originally, I'm reminded of when Steve Jobs famously said, we're not going to do a video iPod. Why would you put video on an iPod? And like 3 weeks later, they announced a video iPod, right? Like, it's not interesting to you until you decide to change. And one of the things that was great about Jobs, and I think a trait that I see in Netflix, is once it makes sense to change your mind, you change your mind. And
right.
It's impossible for me to think that they would spend billions and billions and billions of dollars on Warner Brothers and then just chuck the entire theatrical aspect of the company. I think they look at it and say, right now, Netflix being a theatrical player totally doesn't make sense. But if we had our own studio and our own distribution system, it would make sense. And so I just find it very funny that people are like, well, I don't trust you, Ted Sarandos. You're just all about streaming. And it's like, is he though? Like, he is now, because his business is streaming. But if he buys this, his business will also be theatrical.
Here's how you can think. This is an analogy that's just coming up in my head as we're talking, so it may go nowhere, and in which case I apologize to you, dear listener. But to me, think of Netflix writ large as sort of Pac-Man over the last 10, 15 years, right? Ooh. They're on a playing field. The playing field, the maze, is the entertainment ecosphere. And they are, the pellets are your attention span and your time. Netflix has been looking to get through this maze to get as much of your time, and of course, therefore, your money, and to command as much of your attention as possible by any means necessary. And at first, the way they got into your home and it caught your attention was, hey, we're going to give you DVDs faster than anyone else. So that was great. And then technology was starting to come up and high-speed broadband was coming to be. Things like, aha, we can change it and we can go and direct to consumer. Great. And then they saw that they could do some of that by renting content. And they realized, ooh, this is really becoming successful. People love this. Other studios are starting to take notice. They're going to probably start getting into it. We better start making our own shows because we can only get so much of your attention with the stuff that's out there, especially if other people compete. So they're going to make original shows and constantly changing for attention. And they made their own movies because guess what? Why did they start increasing their spend on big budget movies? Was because people at Bob Iger and Warner Brothers and Paramount said, we're going to start our own streaming services. We're not going to rent our movies to Netflix. So Netflix had to go make its own movies. And everything's changed. Now they still want to make movies. Theater owners are sort of the same thing. They weren't going to make movies in theaters because there was no, that wasn't Netflix commanding your attention for their ecosystem, right? There was no benefit to that, really. Now they've gotten so big that, all right, what's another way to get people's attention? It's getting people in movie theaters because, well, we own the studio and Warner Brothers has the infrastructure to sell those movies, so it makes sense. So yes, now we can get into it. So again, maybe this didn't go anywhere, but the thing is, I think Netflix is most interested in is getting your attention by whatever means makes sense at the time. Movie theaters might not have made sense 5 or 10 years ago because they weren't trying to ruin movie theaters, but they were trying to get as much time as possible. Streaming writ large is harmful to theaters because, like video games, like podcasts, it's another way for people to spend their time. And theater owners, unfortunately, don't want to seem to admit that it's not a particular service that's a problem. It's technology. It's amazing television sets that cost nothing. It's with better sound, and it's streaming on demand for convenience, and it's overall inflation that makes everything expensive. Yeah, that's why you're, and it's COVID for people now who don't go to movies as much as possible because they maybe are older and just don't want to go out in crowds, or they don't like who's in the crowds because everyone's in there on their phone. There are lots of reasons the movie business has gone to hell. Netflix is part of it to the extent that it's a streaming service, but it's not really the main reason movie business is challenged. All right, I'll shut up now.
Okay, who are the ghosts in this scenario?
Yeah, the ghosts are all the cable networks that no longer exist. Anyway.
All right. There goes Versant. We're just going to, Versant turns blue and we eat them too.
Yes.
Okay. That's good. Okay. Love it. Pac-Man. Anyway, I mean, we'll see how it goes, but personally, I love the idea. I would love to see what Netflix does in transforming their business like that. I think it would be really interesting to watch. I'm a lot less interested in the Paramount just eating Warner Brothers alive and it doesn't really excite me. But we'll see.
And I will say one more thing about the theater chains, which is probably better than that giant convoluted analogy of mine with Pac-Man, which is that theater owners, however, do really also remind me of network affiliates who are constantly battling any sort of change in the ecosystem. And as a result, network TV keeps getting weaker and weaker. And movie theater owners, like, they're right to fight for some sort of exclusivity. The real thing is what's going to get people into their movie theaters? It shouldn't matter. The audience that wants to watch movies and they can be two different audiences, just like the people who watch Dancing with the Stars on ABC and Hulu, or rather Disney Plus, are not always as much of an overlap as you think.
Right.
So.
Right. This episode of Downstream is brought to you by Ecamm. If you're a Mac user who creates video or podcasts, you need Ecamm Live. It's the all-in-one studio built exclusively for the Mac, so it looks, feels, and performs like a native pro app should. Whether you're live streaming, recording a podcast, producing training videos, Ecamm gives you broadcast-level control with drag-and-drop simplicity. Switch cameras, share your screen, cue overlays, and control audio all without leaving your Mac. I am an Ecamm Live customer. I pay for Ecamm Live because I like that it's a native Mac app and feels smooth and good, and I understand how it works in a way that some alternatives feel alien to me. It just, as a Mac user, Ecamm Live totally makes sense because Ecamm understands the Mac, understands Apple's platforms. We use it for Six Colors Live events, and we use it for Total Party Kill streaming. I use the Zoom integration, which is amazing because it means that instead of having to capture a Zoom screen and carve it up in a little bit so I can show all the people on my live stream in their own little boxes, instead of just a Zoom capture, with the Zoom integration, I can just assign each person to a window. And then the next time we do a D&D session, for example, they just pop back into that window because each individual window is channeled out of Zoom. And I still have the full Zoom interface on top of it. It's so clever. It's so smart. It's definitely my preferred way to do live streams, and that's why I use it now. And then out of that, not only am I streaming that live to YouTube, I'm getting that out as a full 4K video file on my hard drive to build a video podcast with. And it's so good start to finish. With Ecamm, you can brand your show with titles and graphics and lower thirds. You can pull in guests. They have their own interview mode. Like I said, there's Zoom integration. They have multi-track audio that they can record for perfect post-production. And I haven't even mentioned the automation. Ecamm works beautifully with tools and apps like Stream Deck and Loopback, as well as many Mac tools you already know and love. I use this with Stream Deck. I have little buttons to push that change the setup of my live stream while I'm going, so I don't have to be clicking around an interface while I'm on camera. And I use it with Loopback to control the audio that's going in and out. So good. It's using my existing setup, and then it just slides right in because it's a smart, good native Mac app. You can upgrade to Pro and unlock what I was talking about earlier. Ecamm for Zoom. Feed your polished setup straight into Zoom meetings or webinars. You can broadcast into Zoom from Ecamm Live. You can share Zoom comments up on screen and even capture every participant's audio and video separately for post-production work. This is super important to me. That's one of the reasons I'm using Ecamm Live. Don't wait any longer. Go check it out now. You can get 15% off by going to ecamm.com. That's ecamm.com/downstream and use the code downstream15 for 15% off. That's ecamm2ms.com/downstream1m and use the code downstream15 for 15% off. Thank you to Ecamm for supporting Downstream and all of Relay and for powering my live streams. All right, let's do a letter. I have a letter from listener Eric here that is following up from last episode. One of the pluses, Eric says, of going to services versus just keeping cable is that you can stop a service easily. Casey wants ESPN for football season, but then he can cancel for the summer and restart next fall. It's much harder to stop cable. I thought this was a point that it's a great point. I should have mentioned it last time when we were talking about, you know, what my friend Casey's going to do, that one of the things that is so freeing about not being trapped in a cable subscription where they're your provider for internet and TV, and like if you cancel your TV, what do you do, is it's so easy to turn services off and on, and they hate it because it's churn, and that's why they want to bundle everything and give you a deal for a year and all of those things. But Eric's absolutely right. One of the beauties of this is you could get YouTube TV for football season, for example, and then just cancel it. And, you know, I have done that. I did that when I had Fubo and it didn't have TBS. We showed the baseball playoffs, some of the baseball playoffs. And so I got Sling for a month because it had TBS and it was the cheapest thing that had TBS. And then I turned it back off, and it's just sort of like painless to do that kind of thing. And that is one of the great things about, as confusing as it is to have everything be a la carte, essentially, one of the advantages is you could turn something on for the season and then turn it back off again. And that goes for things like YouTube TV. It's not just for streaming services. So thanks, Eric, for writing it. I thought that was interesting.
It pays to be smart, but also why these companies, you know, Zaslav has been saying for years now, they got to figure out the bundle. And that's why some of these YouTube TV ones will be very interesting to see what incentives they offer people to stay for like expensive sports packages.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, let's do some TV picks before we go. Shows that we've been watching that we like and we want to recommend to you, dear listener. Joe, what do you have for me?
Well, you know, I go through phases on shows and do slow binges on. One show I'm watching now that is sort of seasonal for me, try to watch it in the fall and winter when I first started last year, was All Creatures Great and Small on PBS. It's a UK show that's been around for about 5-6 years here. It's one of the executive producers, Sir Colin Callender, who used to be the head of movies and miniseries at HBO, sort of the legendary guy there. And I think we talked about him a year ago on the podcast, but he's behind it. And it's just this, you know, great sort of British show about veterinarians in pre-World War II England. But it's just the ultimate cozy winter fall drama. It's sort of their version of Golden Girls, but set in a small town and a village rather, and wherever it is in
England. I can't say what the big TV analog would be. Maybe a little, I mean, Northern Exposure vibes a little bit, not quite as quirky as that, but it's like, it's just a sweet story about, you know, veterinarians in the north of England in, pre and during and post World War II. So they're driving around old cars and based on a series of novels. I watched the original show when I was a kid. And then this remake, which started during the pandemic, basically is, it's so good. It's on PBS and they're airing on PBS stations. If you sign up to donate to your local PBS station and get PBS Passport, you can watch you can binge the whole season. It's on the PBS app. Yeah. It's so good. And I just finished the latest season. And one of the things that struck me about it is that it's really well made. The writing, they approach the season thematically. They know where the characters are going. The characters are going to have kind of like their moments to change and grow, and that there's stuff in episode 6, because they're short seasons, that are payoffs from episode 1, where it's just a character progressing in a way that is kind of touching. And like, I don't know, it's just so good. It is very cozy. If you're somebody who wants cozy but maybe doesn't want mystery, How about some sick sheep and cows and stuff instead of mystery? It's just the vets.
And a great romance story. And a great romance that I can already tell where it's going, in part because, well, I actually don't know, but based on the pictures, I'm imagining that people get together, which is in another show, which maybe next time I'm on, I'll talk about Doc Martin and Best Medicine. But that's another British show. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's really great. I had this on my list to recommend, and Joe was like, I can recommend that one. I love it. The originals on
BritBox. I'm way behind, though.
People are curious. You can go to BritBox and you can watch all those originals with Christopher Timothy and Peter Davison. But it's really good. Good cast. Love it. So good. I'm going to choose something that you also said you would be happy to pick, which is A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms on HBO Max. It is a Game of Thrones show, but it is a Game of Thrones show like none other. It's based on a series of novellas that George R.R. Martin wrote. I have read them. The novellas are delightful. This is
no spoilers, please.
This is small scale. And this season is based on the first of the series of novellas. So there's plenty of material here. It's small scale. It is about a hedge knight, this tall guy, Sir Duncan the Tall, who kind of he's trying to find his place in the world. He was a squire for a knight, another hedge knight who died. He's now picked up a squire who is this very odd, bald kid named Egg. So it's Duncan Egg. And he's going to try to enter a joust. That's sort of where it starts. But like, I can just say, it's delightful. It's funny. It's sweet. Yeah, it is. It really is. And if you were somebody who was turned off by Game of Thrones because of the tone and the darkness and the violence and all of that, I would say, give A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms a shot. It's really good. It's so not like Game of Thrones. Even, you know, this is just, it's set in the world, but this goes for the stories too. Like, the stories are so not like the novels. This is like George R. R. Martin taking a break and just having fun with another kind of mythic story set in his same mythological world, but on a very human scale. And it's just kind of funny and delightful, and it is exciting, but it's mostly just kind of charming. And I love it. I've only seen the first one, but like, it is everything that I'd hope it would be based on having read the novellas.
And I went into it completely blind. I didn't read a single review. All I knew was that it was a little more comedic in tone, and that originally was developed as a Duncan Egg. Throughout the first 20 minutes or so, I was like, well, who's going to be Egg? I didn't even know who it was going to be. Is it going to be this guy? Is it going to be this guy? Because it was the guy,
the kid,
you know,
whose head looks like an egg.
Well, okay, yes, thank you. But like, I was like, but I actually thought it's like, oh, there's no way it's going to be a kid's side. Because I literally didn't know. I thought Egg was just another dude. Like, I didn't think it was actually going to be a kid. I was like, it's George R. R. Martin. You don't have kids like doing real roles. Like, I mean, well, unless they're going to be king, which this guy, I don't know. There's something up with this guy. This Egg is not who he seems. I don't know anything, but there's something shady that he's a little
I'm
more
I'm not going to say anything,
anyway,
Joe, but you're
I've
just
been told by other
person.
People at HBO, it's like, keep watching. So I will keep watching. But which seems mythology. But, you know, I mean, other than one scene in which was scatological in nature that I was like, okay, I did not need to see all that. But if you watch, I also love to watch, and I'm glad that even though this show is smaller in scale, and Casey Bloys actually told me it's being made for a fraction of the cost of any Game of Thrones show, they do the behind the scenes things. I don't know if you stayed tuned for that. And they said, hope everyone forgives us. And I do, because of course it automatically signaled, because it, without giving too much away, it starts with the, you hear the stirrings of the familiar Game of Thrones theme song, and you think, ah, that's what this is. And then this thing happens.
A too scatological,
like,
joke that brings you back down to earth.
Okay. That's not what this is.
That's not what the show is.
And yeah, I just was completely, and there's another scene, one of our writers at Vulture wrote about this, a scene sort of in a banquet hall where Dunk is interacting with, I don't know what he's like, not the king, whatever he is, that guy is.
He's some lord,
He's some lord, some big guy who looks evil, whatever. He's like, okay, who's going to die here? Someone's going to get his, or at least who's going to get his hand cut off? And spoilers again here, nothing happens bad. And I was like, oh, wow, that's nice. And then the final thing I loved about this, Jason, is the music. And the music was just lovely. I mean, you don't say that with Game of Thrones, which has always had great music, yes, but very stirring. But it helped with the mood. Mm. And I'm just like, I want to listen to this soundtrack, because it was just, it was another character on the show, as the best soundtracks are. And it just, it took me by surprise as I watched it on Monday. And I can't wait for these other episodes. And the good news is the intent is for this to come back every year. So like The Pit, you're not going to have to wait two seasons. So every year there will be a Game of Thrones show of some sort on HBO Max. And of course, this year we get another season of House of the Dragon as well this summer.
Yeah, it is. I hesitate to call a Game of Thrones show cozy, but in the terms of Game of Thrones, this is cozy. Night of the Seven Kingdoms, it's really good. Well, that brings us to the end. Joe, thank you for being here again. It's been a while. I'm glad to finally hear your voice again.
Glad to hear your voice as well, and glad to be here. And I apologize again to listeners for putting up with my extended Pac-Man analogy.
I loved it. If you haven't yet, please consider subscribing to Downstream Plus. If you are not a Downstream Plus subscriber, we also discuss the state of YouTube, Oscar nominations, Netflix's Star Search, heated rivalry. You get all of that every other episode, more or less. Most of the show is available just for supporters. To support us, go to downstream.plus. You get full versions of every episode, as access to the Relay Discord, where there's a lot of nice people hanging out, including me, bonus shows from Relay, and a lot more. If you have a question or a suggestion, a letter, a comment, downstreamfeedback.com. We love to hear from you. Love to hear from others. You can find me over at sixcolors.com. I appear on many other podcasts at Relay and over at theincomparable.com. You can find Joe's work at vulture.com, and you should subscribe to the Buffering newsletter for the low, low price of free. And that's it for now. We will see you next time.